The Symptomatic Redness Podcast presents conversations on political economy and history, hosted by C. Derek Varn and Amag Sahu. The program was an independent project for several years, but is now hosted by Zero Books on the Zero Squared podcast feed. This first podcast of the new Symptomatic Redness features Amag Sahu interviewing C. Derek Varn on the history and prehistory of human societies. It's Wednesday, March 29th, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the voice behind the Zero Books podcast. Thanks goes out to Zero Books Club members. This week's Inside Zero Books will feature the second part of this conversation from Symptomatic Redness.
Mo, you and I have decided to kind of embark on a series where you basically ask me stuff, and we limit it to a singular topic like we did on the Standpoint Epistemology episode and the political theology slash Nietzsche slash problem of consciousness episode, although that's a little bit broader. Mm-hmm. Before we really start, why did you want to do this? Because this was your idea.
Right.
And then we'll talk about what we're specifically talking about today.
Right. So what I was really coming off of was your sentiment about talking about the left. I mean, to some extent, I've gotten tired of it as well, about repeating the same critiques about the corruption of Marxism and so on and so forth, and obviously sounding like a bit of a reactionary at times. What I really wanted to do was to sort of take a strand that was emerging through our conversations where talking about history, particularly the history of politics and the history of myth and culture and so on, and how those contribute to the way, you know, the problem of consciousness stuff and so on and so forth. And doing that systematically seemed to me to be the place to go, because it seemed to me to be, one, what you sort of seem, where you seem to be heading anyway, judging simply by where you pulled conversation, and two, seems to be a theme that you know, is important to you and something that you've been working with for a very long time. And certainly the sort of intellectual justification for coming to this is in that podcast, in terms of how we basically work through the problems of Marxism and end up at consciousness.
Right. So my thought on that is, you're absolutely right. For me lately, when I talk about the left and the history of the left, the tangents I go into are more interesting than the history of the left itself. Mm-hmm. It's been that way for me for a while, actually. Mm-hmm. For listeners may or may not know about my prior podcasting history, but for about a year and a half, off and on, and then revived about a year later for about three episodes, I did a show called Pop the Left with Douglas Lane, which was a supplement to the Diet Soap podcast. We killed it twice. We killed it the first time because I just got sick of talking about the stuff after 10 episodes. And then we killed it again when basically Zero Books got the rights to Doug's podcasting. Mm-hmm. To go back, I feel like people have heard my critique of the left.
It is now out there.
Yeah, it is out there. What they don't understand, other than like specific historical things that I bring up, is the larger philosophical, historical, you know, ontological, metaphysical,
whatever,
anthropological, all your logicals, kind of series of frameworks that I'm coming from, because while Marxism is sort of assumed, there's a lot of other stuff you have to deal with.
One thing I really wanted to emphasize for this new direction is what we're really trying to do is to put as little on the table as possible in terms of like implicit notions that people are assuming and, you know, like heavy ontological baggage that we just bring on, you know, we don't really mention because it's not the topic and so on. This is what, you know, being really systematic about things and, you know, really saying that here's all this stuff we normally keep in the background and let's foreground that.
Right. And so half of this is going to be just basic explication, kind of me teaching things.
Mm-hmm. I mean, as long as you don't mind that, I'm okay.
Yeah. And half of this is going to be an intellectual genealogy.
Yeah.
So it's not just me teaching things. It does add up to something. The episodes for listeners that function this way are one that happened before you and I actually did this podcast, and we were doing another kind of project was you called Entitled Thoughts, where we did, I don't know, something like 5 hours
on the history of education.
On the history of education and Weberian and Marxist models of education as applied to my personal experience around the world.
That's also out there, guys, if you want to get that.
I think, and a lot of people agree with me, it's really good. It's also 5 hours long, and I didn't document everything as well as I should have, and it was not systematic enough in the sense that it was just like, hey, here's my mega theory of the development of educational forms.
Yeah.
I'm not giving you the context for that except for the history. Have a nice day.
Yeah.
And
a little bit at the end about the narcos or something.
Well, yeah, when I mentioned narco culture at the end. And the other example would be my sort of work both in the podcast and outside of it in some blogs and some stuff I wrote for the North Star many years ago about the weird relationship of Marxism to standpoint epistemology, which has become some of my bugbear. But frankly, even that, you need to understand a lot of other stuff to get.
But even before you read the sort of your early interviews on your blog, right, with like Wiccans and all that stuff.
Oh yeah, I mean, there's.
So this goes back, sort of this theme about religion and politics and stuff.
Well, yes. My very first interviews with Douglas Lane, the things that got me on in his radar, actually, but way before Occupy happened. I think this is 2011. Pre-Occupy and during Occupy was a series of interviews I did where I was doing this weird mirroring, talking to what I saw as marginal political figures and marginal religious figures, particularly pagans and Gnostics and occultists. I was basically pointing out that they're all kind of responding to problems in modernity in kind of a haphazard way. And when I was doing these interviews, I interviewed some people who were considered important in the field, even in the scholarly sense, and some just people I met off the street. I mean, and I was actually trying to do this big ethnological study that I was going to publish in an academic journal, and then I realized, oh my God, this would take a million years to do correctly. I'm going to release these as blogs. And I was a professor at I was a lecturer, not a professor, which is a subtle distinction, but it is one.
It really bites when you're in the hierarchy.
Yeah, it matters in the sense that I was not adjunct. I was real faculty, real faculty. Don't want to insult people, but the Koreans would talk about my title because my title was in Korean, translated to lecturer roughly. But it was basically lowest level of real professor.
Right.
That was me. Now, that said, what does that mean? What did that mean? That means I was a struggling academic, trying to write on a variety of subjects. And these things were coming out. And kind of at the same time, I did some stuff on Partly Examine Life about Derrida and
Claude linguistics.
Yeah, and linguistics. And which was my job. It was actually my day job at the time. I was a lecturer of literature and linguistics in the English interpretation and translation department of a major Korean university. So linguistics was my day job, but I also taught culture, and that was what I was kind of going into, was marginal cultures and the response to liberal modernity. Mm-hmm. All right. there's two things you need to know about me. My first passion scholastically is not literature, even though that's what most of my work is in. It was anthropology.
Yeah, this explains a lot.
I moved into literature and philosophy later, kind of as an accident of transferring schools. The school I went to did not have a very developed anthropology department. It had a very developed English department. It also had a very developed, or no, actually it was not very developed, but it had a developing philosophy department, and they sort of recruited me. And that's how I got into it. But I've maintained an active interest in anthropology, both historical, social, and forensic. I mean, you know, I do have a morbid fascination with neurology, brain structure, bones, organs. Mm-hmm. Now, what does this have to do with the left? You asked me that. I have no idea.
To some extent, I'm happy to bracket the question.
Yeah. So we can bracket that out. But what does this have to do with, like, the baggage I've come to a lot of these philosophical discussions and interviews with? And you asked me sort of like, what's the concept that goes back the furthest in time that is crucial to your thinking? And for me, it is the historical development of symbolic kinship out of kinship pairing in primates.
Right.
And I've never really talked about that in public. I don't want it to sound like it's my grand theory of everything, because it is not, because I see this very historically contingent.
And you're also still kind of you're also still basically a Marxist about sort of lots of historical trends.
Yeah, I am. And, like, for example, I think the crucial point of Marx, and Marx alone, Engels actually goes completely differently on this. My friend Michael Vettenwald, a professor at NYU, recently pointed out that in Marx, the history of a class struggle is the history of social relations. Mm. All right? Mm. And in Engels, the history of class struggle is the history of modes of production. Mm. He says that in Anti-Doring. That's a very, very different conception.
Yeah.
And I've been sort of into this, you know, Marxist anthropology. And I say Marxist anthropology, most of the anthropologists I'm going to mention, even though the theories might line up with Marx in some way, form, or fashion, Marshall Solons being the biggest one, they are not Marxists.
No, they're not. I mean, I'm just looking at Solons' book, Culture and Practical Reason. He explicitly sort of distances himself from the notion of sort of like practical activity and stuff like that.
Right. With the exception of Bourdieu, who is also really crucial to my thinking, but in a way, they don't even really have a strong relationship to Marx. But I feel like anthropology has been kind of been given over to kind of slapstick anarchism. And I don't mean this as an insult to anarchism, but
Graeber, I mean, being the, like the most recent.
Graeber, but also Sears, and also Bob Black, who I actually really respect in a way, even though people would see our politics as fundamentally different. Bob Black being pretty profoundly anti-Marxist. A bunch of French guys, but Graeber being one of them, you know, the most famous one, also probably the least radical one, where you see anthropology and prior social forms being made a really big deal out of. And I don't see a lot of discussion. Bourdieu, for example, is a sociologist, but he's very interested in anthropology and it's very crucial for the project. I said he was an anthropologist, he's not.
Right.
Claude Rauss is sort of important to my thinking. Remember, we mentioned him in linguistics, but he's in Saussure, but he was an anthropologist, sort of a structural anthropologist. very important to me through my entire career in some ways.
Sorry, who is this again?
And Claude Levi-Strauss.
Oh, right.
You know, kind of takes us there and tries to apply it
yeah,
to...
Yeah, structuralism. Yeah, I just didn't hear the name the first time. Yeah.
Structural anthropology, which, you know, I also get the critique of philosophically. I don't want to get into that.
No, that's well done. That's already, you know, that's one of the early chapters in any first-year anthropology text. Or first year, this year.
Right. I mean, also, I've also just done a podcast on it. So if you want to know my personal opinion on it, listen to me talk to the Pale guys right. 4.5 years ago. So, you know, let's quit the self-referential part. The most important idea to me is kinship and symbolic kinship.
Right.
Marshall Solms is the most influential thinker. He's not the only thinker for this for me. I also find, let's see, give me a second to get the names. Christopher Ryan, the author of Sex at Dawn, who is a serious anthropologist, he's sort of known for his more salacious anthropology on sex, but... is very important for this to me, and sort of the forefather of all this, Robin Fox, is important to this for me.
Right. Robin Fox.
Yeah. So these are all kind of very important. The thing about symbolic kinship is that when I first talk about it, it's going to sound to people who are familiar with evolutionary psychology or sociobiology, it's going to sound like that. But when I actually get to the symbolic part and the historical part, it's going to immediately break apart.
Hmm.
Right. So.
Hence what are symbolic, not just kinship.
Yeah. Right. We need to start with kinship.
Okay. Let's start with kinship.
Human society is a primate social society, right?
Yeah.
No matter what we believe about materialism or religion, if we go off the evidence we have, we're going to have a baseline, a set of assumptions that we evolved from some primate, well, not from some, from a very specific set of humanoid primates, right. That there are several varieties of which.
Right.
That there's evidence very early on, before we even get to modern humans, but by that I mean Homo sapiens, and even maybe Homo Neanderthalus, that there's symbolic relations going on. But we tend to move in tribal pairs, which have strong kinship ties. Okay?
Yeah. Kinship, both in terms of, obviously, you know, reproduction, but there's some controversy about whether it should be defined in terms of reproduction or in terms of marriage or in terms of adoption and so on. But basically,
right.
That's the area that we're talking about.
Of reproduction and consanguinity.
Right. Yeah.
Both. All right. We're going to include both in this base definition of kinship.
Right.
Right. Okay. This is what sounds like Evo Psych. A lot of our motivations are modeled off of these assumptions of shared genetics. All right? I do not mean here that there's somehow some gene that we all understand shared genetics from. And when I talk about symbolic kinship, more specific examples, it'll be very clear that there's a real distinction between that and social biology. But early on, we bond to people who we either are fucking or we're related to.
Right.
And
we're really getting down to brass tacks, aren't we?
I mean, and most social things are based on this. Now, I would say this is a familial model of human society. The problem I have with saying that, though, is people impose a nuclear or even a agricultural idea with this upon it. where there's clear parent parental assent. There is either matriarchal or patriarchal authority patterns. There's some notion of private ownership within the family, and the state is based off of, well,
I'm incest really, prohibition, although we'll get
there. Right, right. Yeah. Most early theories of psychological development, Freud, social contract theorists and all that, actually sort of assume this.
Yeah.
Right. Social
case, the you know, basically the patriarchal matriarchal dynamic, the Oedipus myth, and all that stuff.
The primal man.
Right.
Religion as an abstractification of that.
Right.
I don't think there's evidence for that.
Hmm.
Right. I do think there's evidence for concerns about blood relations and consanguinity.
Hmm.
I don't think there's evidence that actually meant. Patriarchal and matriarchal descent lines. And the reason why I think that is Christopher Ryan's work on ancient societies and hunter-gatherer societies indicates, and also the work on genetics that we know, that partner bonds and stuff like that in ancient pre-agricultural man do not seem to be anything related to the way we think of families now.
So this pre-agricultural is really important, just to clarify the historical era we're sort of limiting ourselves to.
It's super important. I mean, I'm also going to say, unlike the evil psych people, I do not think human psychology is somehow just some remnant of hunter-gatherer thing that lingers on despite all historical change. I think that's nuts.
Yeah.
The reason why
you simply explain every aspect of human social organization in the current period with reference to, you know, some kind of faith concept.
Even though, you know, you have to do that, you also have to impose current family dynamics all the way back in history.
Right.
And even in agricultural settings, there's enough writings about semi-nomadic peoples from classical period, for example.
Right.
They're always talking about, oh, those crazy people share wives in common.
Mm-hmm.
As sort of these settled agricultural peoples would talk about these more nomadic peoples, some of which were semi-settled, by the way. I mean, this includes early Etruscans, the way the Romans and the Greeks were about Etruscans. Indicate that, oh no, it was not like that at all.
Mm.
That tribal bonds were consanguineous, but they're also really mixed up.
Mm-hmm.
That unlike chimpanzees and gorillas, that there was mating allowed between non-dominant males with other members of the tribe.
Right.
And the moment you talk about that, you're dealing with a fundamentally different social dynamic than what most evolutionary biologists are talking about.
Right. So this is still what I guess we think of as like hunter-gatherer bands or like small tribes.
Yeah.
Hunter-gatherer right.
bands, small tribes of basically hominid primates.
Right. Is this what
we don't know much about non...
Sorry, this is the same thing as what Marx called the tribes of the ancient states, or is that later on?
I would say that's later on. The tribes of the ancient states would be the transition to agriculture.
I see.
And to be fair, no one in Marx's time knew about any of this.
Mm-hmm.
If they talked about this, it would have been purely speculative.
Right.
To know about this requires extensive studies of societies that were very remote to Europeans in the 19th century,
mm-hmm.
In the 18th century.
Mm.
Extensive studies of genetics.
Hmm.
Extensive studies of very risky parts of human anatomy that don't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
If you assume simple pair bonding and so like even things like the shape of the penis. I don't even really want to go into that,
mm-hmm.
but it is related.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a baseline of what I would say is a what, you know, when people talk about species being or whatever,
mm-hmm.
which I kind of just roll my eyes at.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's just the reason I brought Marx up is it's important to establish like the differences and or continuity between what you're talking about now and sort
right.
of the Marxist historiography, because that begins at like so-called tribal states, right?
Right. It begins at tribal states in an Oriental, in quote-unquote Oriental despot.
Right.
But
we were before that.
Asiatic modes of production, mm-hmm. which is...
I guess the point I was making is that we're before that right now.
We're before that.
Yeah.
We are in what could be considered pre-technological or semi-technological states of man. I say semi-technological because I actually don't think there's such a thing as something call a hominid that's pre-technological. I know there are thinkers, particularly primitivists who disagree with me. I think that basically the moment you're dealing with hominids of any significant advance, including ones that currently exist, who are not hominids but are closely related, like chimpanzees and bonobos, you already have technology.
Right.
In the rudest sense.
Right.
So, I'm not going to get on to the... You know, this relates to why I don't consider myself anti-civilization, because I don't even think the notion of civilization is coherent.
Yeah.
I mean, I talk about civilizational projects sometimes, but that's
or
a metaphor.
Modernity.
Yeah, it's a metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
So what is symbolic kinship? Sometime in this time that we don't really know about, we do know that hominins develop communication. We don't know if it starts with Homo sapiens. There's some indication it might be earlier, because you see symbolic gestures before that in ritual burial pattern evidence and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some notion of kinship, and there's also some notion that there's a way to extend kinship to people you are not blood related to.
Right.
The simplest way to see that is in the idea of entering the tribe or marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Now, marriage is complicated. As to when marriage actually exists in any form that we can think about anything meaning like marriage, we have no idea.
Mm.
We don't know. All right? Even, for example, in biblical text, to talk about this in... Just to my, you know, my knowledge of religion, but the word for wife doesn't even exist in the first part of the Torah.
Right.
It just refers to his or her, his woman.
Right.
They translate it as wife, but the Hebrew is actually his woman. There's no codified marriage ceremony. There's none of that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. That's from that, and then there's from religious literature, and that's really super, super late.
Right.
What we think of as marriage seems to be late, but joining the tribe does not seem to be late.
Hmm.
What does that mean? What is the tribe? Well, the tribe is, in some loose way, a kinship tie. It's like a family,
right?
But it's broader.
Yes.
It's
Maybe the word family is slightly unhelpful in this instance, considering what people project onto it.
Right. I mean, because you're projecting, notions of clear, you know, cousins and brothers and sisters,
yes.
And.
So maybe, all I'm saying is that maybe we should call our units of analysis something else, like tribe or, I don't know, maybe some smaller.
I would actually say that it's like a family in the sense that it was probably semi-cosanguis.
I see.
Okay.
So you're saying the tribe was like a family.
Yeah, or the tribe is something like a less codified family. There is less hierarchy in it from what we can tell. That's not to say there's none, all right? There's some anarchists who say there's no hierarchy. There obviously is hierarchy in the sense that there does seem to have been provisional leadership.
Right. And you have probably some vague idea of division of labor in a like formal sense.
Although it's much, much less extreme
right.
than in an agricultural society.
Right. Which is the traditional Marxist narrative, right? Progression of history equals progression of division of labor.
Right. So the progression of history is progression of division of labor. The need for the division of labor is much, much less extreme in agricultural society because basically the only real dividing line is going to be gathering versus hunting.
Right.
There is some evidence that there was a slight difference in propensity here because of humans' physical dimorphism.
Right.
But even then, we don't know how much difference there was and what role women played. We don't know because the models we have from hunter-gatherer societies that currently exist are kind of all over the place.
Right.
Women do have fairly high status compared to men.
Right.
But again, I don't want to say that.
That isn't the important bit you seem to say.
That's not the important bit. Right. The important bit is that there is a notion of a cohesive group. They speak a cohesive language, probably, or at least shared set of symbolic communications, symbolism, identification traits. Probably, it could be as simple as face paint or scarification. And again, we don't have a lot of evidence because soft tissues don't survive. But we do have evidence of burial rites that indicate this. And we definitely have evidence of it in contemporary hunter-gatherer societies. In contemporary hunter-gatherer societies vary greatly in their relationship to violence. Some of them are extremely violent, some of them are not. And their relationship to social structure.
Right.
The hierarchies are looser. Pair bonding is looser. There would be more things that would be considered by contemporary humans as semi-promiscuous behavior, but only within the group.
Right. Ryan, from what I'm looking at, seems to talk about appetite for sexual novelty and stuff like that.
Right. Which, again, you hear a lot of sort of the gist of stories of Evo Psych.
Yeah.
But appetite for sexual novelty would have still been limited within your tribe.
One thing we really should quash as well while we're on here is the sort of Marcuse, the Eros and Civilization narrative, where free love is the sort of original state of being.
I don't think that's exactly what's going on.
Right.
For one, free love is a concept that wouldn't have made sense without marriage.
Right.
As we think of it. Mm-hmm. And marriage as a property transaction.
Right.
And marriage as a property transaction, frankly, doesn't make any damn sense when
there's no... Are you saying marriage is a property transaction back then?
No, I'm saying it doesn't make any sense back then because, and quite simply, there isn't property without agriculture.
Right.
There are things that maybe belong to the tribe, and you might have fetishistic attachment to particular items. Mm-hmm. All right, but trade is only between groups, not intertribal. Furthermore, since there's a potential for consanguinity between anyone in the tribe and anyone else, Ryan talks about this.
Right.
So you're
saying the boundaries of the tribe are like pretty porous?
They're pretty porous within the tribe. They're extremely non-porous between tribes.
Right.
However, there is evidence that people got adopted into tribes. One, if they hadn't have been, the mating pool for any particular group would have been super small. And that would have been bad. I mean, obviously, you would have co-sanguinity rates would have gotten too high. There would have been lots of defects and problems that come from, you know, too close co-sanguinity,
right,
and so forth. So symbolic kinship immediately seems to be pretty crucial.
Right.
To taking people into the tribe. Whether they are outcasts, whether they are whatever.
Where does the symbolic element come in exactly? We've been talking a lot about kinship.
So symbolic kinship is the extension of identity as if you are a consanguineous member of the tribe to a non-consanguineous person.
Right.
Through the adoption of some kind of cultural form.
Right.
All right. It could be a scarification ritual. It could be a coming of age ritual. It could be something like an adoption into a marriage. We have signs for all of this from societies that existed. And I could talk about Native Americans for a minute. For some of this. For example, some of the Western Native tribes in the United States would often adopt Europeans on the premise that, you know, when someone died or was killed, that they adopted that person's identity.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
So they were assuming an identity role for another individual. Now, this is interesting because people particularly, you know, sociobiological people and people on the evil side would have a hard time explaining how a group would take in someone as a member of another group when they are obviously not consanguineous.
Right.
See, obviously, because you're talking about different skin tones.
Hmm.
All right? Look into ancient agricultural definitions of what it meant to be an other group.
Mm-hmm.
All right? You were born into it or what?
Hmm. You're adopted into it.
Or you are adopted into it.
Right.
All right? But you can be adopted into it by adopting the language and the gods or whatever religious structure. Not all religious structures in their ancient have gods either, by the way.
Whatever sort of like entry criteria in order
whatever
to
whatever
like,
sort of criteria that right. usually involves kind of symbolic transference of culture.
Mm-hmm.
And then you are seen literally as a member of the family. I can use an example from Judaism verbatim.
Right.
Once you would, you know, to be a Jew, you had to get, you know, adopt the ritual scarification practice of Judaism.
Right.
Get circumcised, and learn Hebrew.
Right.
But if you did that, in rabbinic Judaism, we know, you know, and this is late, but you were considered as if you were a member of the group.
Hmm.
This is very also true in pre-temple and what would we call pre-temple or first temple Judaism. We have a lot of evidence for that as well. It's only after such simple Judaism when you start seeing something like a racial notion of Judaism emerge. And that has to do with diasporas of empires, actually.
Right.
So that's jumping really far ahead. But you have a symbolic transfer of kinship. There is a belief that you can be expanded into the tribe.
Right.
If you take Marshall Solins's view of symbolic kinship, this is the foundation of almost all social structure. The ability to make kinship symbolic is the ability to remove someone from an othered position and to accept them into your culture.
Right. So this is the sort of Hegelian dynamics, like you're recognizing that person as person in your culture.
Yeah, I am reckoning you as us, as opposed to as whatever state of nature sort of, you know,
that who is not us or whatever.
Something of which I am in competition for resources with.
Right.
But what's fascinating about this is this really quickly transcends any genetic ties.
Mm-hmm.
Now, from an evolutionary standpoint, this is actually really good. Okay. You're going to get fresh gene stock into your
tribe. Right, higher gene, a more diverse gene pool. And stuff.
Right. So this is all the benefits that are cued from that.
Right.
But there's a lot of evidence that it goes much further than that.
Right.
All right. Now, agriculture does not stop this, but agriculture fundamentally changes it.
Because now we get more like we have our materialist explanations come in more and more.
Right. Now, we don't know really how agriculture fully developed.
Right.
All right. We do know that it still exists in tribal societies. There's still tribes in agricultural societies, although there's an increasing tendency to move away from that.
Right.
The tribe as a unit becomes more and more symbolic and more diffuse. Lines of heredity become actually more important.
Right.
Because it has to do with lines of property.
Ah, right.
And ensuring that your kin line gets property. Now that I know that a lot of people are going to say, oh no, he's going to cite a right-wing thinker in this, and I kind of am. But Fukuyama talks a lot about this in his Development of Political Order. All right, that this notion of family comes out. And Christopher Ryan talks a lot about it too. He says this is the origins of both male-centric polygamy and monogamy.
Right.
It has to do with what you need to do in an agricultural society to ensure your resources, because private property becomes private accumulation becomes much more important.
And so the notion of the family comes up from these property relations in agriculture.
Right. But this is where symbolic kinship can do things like, oh, why would you? Now, I'm not saying symbolic kinship explains religion.
Mm-hmm.
Religion is actually far too diverse and complicated of a thing to explain that way. For one thing, right. I don't even know that religion is a coherent concept until the 17th century.
Right.
Which will shock people, but I can shock people who aren't up on current religious studies. But,
right.
But that there's all these cultural forms, all these ways of being a people. And even in early Christianity, the church fathers talk about Christians as an ethnoi.
Right.
As a people, the ecclesia and ethnoi.
Right.
The assembly and the people, which gets turned into the church and the people, but it literally means in Koine Greek, the assembly and the people. Mm. Are ways of increasingly symbolic ways to form groups, all right, and subordinate groups. But also that transcend, you know, by the time you get to the classical period, they can transcend nationalities, they can even transcend languages.
Mm.
That's what the religious stuff seems to be about.
Right.
Partially. It does, like, again, I don't want this to, you know, I don't want this to be think, oh, Varn is seizing on
symbolic
kinship as a, you know, universal theory of everything, because one thing is symbolic kinship does not explain class structure.
Right. The thing is, symbolic kinship doesn't seem to be that kind of structure in you. Symbolic kinship seems to be like this form in which you explain other in-group, out-group relations.
Well, it explains like how social relations are mediated by in-group, out-group divisions.
Right. But I mean, I guess like what people would
frankly is not a concern of Marxism. I mean, Marxism does not deal with that.
Right.
At all, anywhere.
Right. I mean, I guess what I was stressing was that you aren't being like, when you think you're talking about kinship, you aren't sort of like tracing everything back to some kind of biological principle, right?
No, I'm tracing things back to the what I would see as a interplay or a dialectic between a symbolic mechanism of identity.
Right. Identity and difference, which is, you know, one of the
identity and difference with fairly biocentric views about why people formed up in groups and what you would have seen as patterns from what we observed from other primates and hunter-gatherer societies and all that. The thing about this, there is an assumption that hunter-gatherers were intellectually primitive.
Mm-hmm.
That is just an assumption. One thing I agree with the primitives about is there's a lot of evidence that certain kinds of intelligence that hunter-gatherers have, we have frankly just lost.
Mm-hmm.
And
but again, not in a primo sense. It wasn't some kind of like divine grace, which we felt.
No, not at all. It's just these are not things that we need as much. In fact, if anything, what it implies is maybe something like a head. You know, Hegel may have actually fell onto this by accident from Christian theology, ironically, because this would have been an accident. But the abstractification is a human process that has to do with with a basic level of identification and in-group, out-group cohesion and in-group, out-group. I mean, in-group social maintenance.
Right.
But the division of labor within this in-group social maintenance would have led to, when paired with other symbolic structures, classes developing, religions developing, so forth and so on.
But agriculture is also an important prerequisite for this, right?
Oh, totally. Because without agriculture, tribal systems are way more stable.
Right.
You don't have as much in-group competition.
Right.
Because while there's plenty of evidence for individual pair bonding and that people would have got their feelings hurt, there would have been some level of understanding that anyone within most tribes, and again, I don't want to say that this is true for all tribal societies, because tribal societies would have been diverse just like agricultural societies actually are. Okay?
Right.
There isn't actually a set form of agricultural society either. But in most tribal societies, there would have been understanding that most members of the group who were not, say, your mother and sister would have been revealed. There was probably some sort of immediate incest taboo. But maybe not. There are instances of societies that don't have it, but most societies do.
But the incest taboo happens after agriculture or the previous.
No, probably before it. I mean, you wouldn't. And it probably would have just been from practical observation, like you sleep with your mom, weird stuff happens.
Right.
I mean, you know, Freud be damned.
Right.
But Freud is onto something. People are attracted to people who look like their mother.
Right.
Because they're people who look similar to them, because it's an indication of kinship.
Right.
However, there's ever bit of evidence that people can overcome that really fast.
Right.
And
this is this whole in-group, out-group, bringing the other in, and so on and so forth. That's the,
right.
Yeah.
And would have been fairly common and fairly advantageous.
Right.
But the only way to justify that, in a kind of social dynamic setting, would probably have been, you know, through some kind of, you know, symbolic transference of identity that would be a proxy for consanguinity or a proxy for literal kinship.
And if obviously what you're suggesting is that if something can be transferred, the sort of transference creates a conception of self-identity, creates tribe, and so on.
Right.
There needs to be another for there to be an identity, but also once you transfer identity, you sort of, you know, grow to appreciate your own identity.
And again, like Hegel's, you know, subject-object distinctions and the fact that the subject only exists in reflection, and that reflection can only exist in a social order.
Right.
Right. Because to see yourself as an object requires you to symbolize yourself in some way.
Yes.
Because it requires a self-conception, which is a symbol without which you do not have a self-conception.
Right.
Self-conception is not physically real. You know, that, again, Hegel may have been operating off of really weird Christian prepositions, okay? I'm not saying he came to this fundamental truth by sound logic from an anthropological point of view. It might have been sound logic from other points of view, but not from an anthropological point of view. But he seems to have been onto something.
Right. But obviously the Hegelian claim is also, you know, the development of concepts and knowledge out of this, right? Initially you confront the world as if it's, you know, sense certainty, and then there's self-alienation and stuff like that.
Well, a sense of a thing requires a differentiation from a thing.
Right.
Which will in itself generate a differentiation of self. Right. This also applies to social groups. Maybe historically applied to social groups first. Again, we don't know. There's no way. I don't know how you even would know that. because you'd have to be in
their head.
Yeah, in the subjected conception of a type of human being that no longer exists.
But in the Hegelian schema, just to make it clear, so what if we were to apply that to this? It would be initially at some point when there was a settled group which simply lived harmoniously in identity or something like that.
Well, I mean, it might not even live harmoniously, but it had an identity.
Right.
I don't want to like paint this as ideal. Like, I am not positing.
No. I mean, this is the great thing. The Hegelian system, that's just a starting point. And in fact, it's bad because it's indeterminate, right?
Right. And, you know, Hegel has a teleology that an anthropologist cannot have.
Right.
An anthropologist cannot assume that history has an endpoint. Mm-hmm. Has to view from a methodological position history as something stochastic, or teleologies as generated from events and contingencies,
right,
more than time, you know, historical developments that have to happen. Frankly, that is a difference between even early modern thought and contemporary modern thought is the relationship of teleos to things.
Yeah.
But to get back to symbolic conception and what Marshall Solms was really talking about, Solms is a big point in what kinship is and isn't.
Right.
Is that symbolic, like, kinship is not purely co-sanguinity.
Right.
It cannot be purely co-sanguinity. It doesn't make sense to say it was. There's plenty of evidence that people being accepted into a tribal group and adopted into a tribe from all sorts of literatures, from all sorts of various cultures, and for evidence of non-literary cultures, and it seems to be pre-agricultural.
Mm-hmm.
In and of itself, it seems to correspond with the development of language.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And this is important to think about pre-modern peoples.
Right.
Is that the two defining ideas of most pre-modern societies, even most particularly agricultural ones, actually,
mm-hmm,
is who you're related to, but also what language you speak.
Mm.
There is no conception of what people who study genetics would call morphology, mm-hmm, equaling identity, and there's no conception of something like we would think of as clear race.
Mm-hmm.
That just
there
doesn't.
There is some basic notion of identity.
Yeah, that just doesn't seem to exist.
Right.
Because what defines a barbarian from a Greek? All right?
Mm-hmm.
Is not just who you're born of.
Mm-hmm.
It's what language you speak.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally in the name.
Right.
You can be adopted into a Greek society through marriage and speaking Greek.
Mm-hmm.
And for all intents and purposes, it does seem like once you do that, you are Greek.
Right.
Now, and that is a very late, very advanced, not only agricultural, but post-agricultural, you have city settlements.
Right.
But this seems to be a consistent trait of human cultures. Now, where does class come in? Class comes in almost immediately with agriculture and
right,
the need to divide labor more profoundly
right,
than before.
Now you have the forces, relations, distinctions.
Right. And this is where, you know, class being the motivator of history kind of may be true in the sense that tribal hunter-gatherer societies are incredibly stable,
right,
even though they're incredibly diverse.
Right.
But they don't innovate very much.
Right.
There's no need to. All right? There is no need for innovation.
Right. They can produce their own subsistence with, you know, simple cultivation and so on.
Now, I won't say there's no innovation because we have evidence that they were, like, permaculturing changes in plants.
Right. Was there irrigation yet? Or
kind of. But also just selective breeding.
I see.
You know, and gathered plants. We got a lot of evidence for that because there's like strains of kinds of genetic changes in plants,
mm-hmm,
from wild plants that seem to predate agriculture. But there's not that. It's still relatively minor. Okay.
Mm.
there's also some domestication of animals, maybe. I mean, it is important to note that pastoral peoples, while not hunter-gatherers, are closer to hunter-gatherers than secular agricultural peoples. And while there is certainly extreme violence in hunter-gatherer societies between bands of individuals who do not speak the same language or belong to the same social group, there's plenty of evidence for that.
Right.
There is not anything like codified war. All right, and that's a pretty big distinction. That does not mean a lot of anarchists will take, particularly primitives will take it. I mean, there's nothing like systematic violence. There is every evidence of in-group, out-group violence all over the place.
Well, there. I mean, you can trace that back to the beginning of this.
Right, but what you don't have evidence for is scapegoating, which we should talk about in a different.
Yes.
You don't have evidence for scapegoating and, like, ritual sacrifice of community members.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, because community members are too important. And you don't have evidence of codified systemic war. Because no need to accumulate territory. I mean, there's a need to, like, inhabit and control territory, kind of. And there probably was a lot of that, but there's no need to really maintain it.
Right.
So, ritualize, even though there's not that many hunter-gatherer societies left, there's actually quite a bit of diversity between the ones we know about.
Right.
In pastoral societies, there's even more diversity. And in, you know, agricultural societies, there is actually somewhat less diversity, but there are then weird outliers.
Mm-hmm.
Like Ryan talks a lot about I believe they're called the Misu people, which is the people who have figured out a different answer to the consanguinity singular household problem than the one that almost everybody else has.
Right.
And that is a matriarchal society in which the father figure is not your biological parent,
right,
but your brother.
Right.
And thus there's a lot of... It's a fairly promiscuous society. It's also incredibly stable. All right, it's incredibly stable.
Right.
In fact, it may be too stable for the modern world.
Right.
So there's that.
One thing I wanted to expand on is you talked about when we spoke before. You talked about class being the macro.
Oh, class, okay. There's micro class, micro class, macro class, and symbolic kinship.
Right. Fine. Okay. Just generally the relationship or the levels of analysis between symbolic kinship and class.
Well, symbolic kinship is clearer the simpler a society is.
Right.
The directness of the level of symbolism and directness to kinship is there. But it's important to remember that even very complex imperial societies, slave societies such as the ancient Near Eastern and Mediterranean societies like the Greeks and Romans,
right,
based most of their models of a city off of a model of a tribe, and they based most of that off of whatever dominant model the family was.
Right.
All right, and so you see... Between differences in models of the family, you actually see fairly distinct differences in models of the people, even between groups that spoke the same language and recognized each other as Hellenes.
Right.
For example, the Spartans and the Athenians had very different, not just models they had very different models of labor, very different models of family, etc. They were a slave society. Slavery itself is probably a compromise. I mean, this is going to sound like it's apologetics. I don't mean it to be. This does not actually apply to chattel slavery, which is a different thing entirely.
Mm-hmm.
But slavery itself...
Greek slavery, or...
I mean, ancient slavery. The way slavery you see, which could be chattel slavery, but was not generally, seemed to have been a compromise between killing an enemy outright and a symbolic kinship bond, which was the use of their labor. But it was seen as more humane than eradicating.
Right.
And they had set prescribed roles, etc., and so forth. But the models of these ancient city-states, polis, politics comes from city, seem to be based on models of tribes, and those tribes are related to models of family.
Right.
So you see kings, you know, kings are referred to as fathers, like gods are referred to as fathers, etc. and so forth. Okay. You don't get that, it seems, until agriculture. Maybe you do, but the other thing is only agricultural societies seem to develop writing. Again, this doesn't seem to be necessary.
Well, none of this is, I mean, unless we're sort of putting teleology into it.
Right. This doesn't seem, well, but it doesn't seem to be necessary for, let's talk about, like, contingent teleology for a second.
Right.
If you have contingent teleologies, certain necessities come from other things that imply a need that would have caused it to develop.
Right.
But the need to move from spoken symbols and physical symbols. I mean, by physical symbols, I mean like body language.
Mm-hmm.
To, you know, scribblings on stone.
Right.
Seem to be tied to the need to tax, which is tied to very complicated and fairly well devised divisions of labor.
Right.
That's why the earliest forms of writing we have are either religious or they're taxation, and that's really all you got.
Which is like a material motivation.
Right. Now you have oral literature.
Right.
Which seems to be all about identity, but you don't have written literature. It actually seems to be like an epiphenomenon of the need to communicate between groups. And you don't get that till you have empires. And to have empires, you need not only agriculture, but you need people who not only oversee everything, but completely don't work.
Right.
But to have that, you have to have a class society.
Uh-huh.
But that's when all these innovations come in.
Right.
And so again, I think Marx is right.
Right.
That as a driver of history, where you start having a lot of necessary teleos.
Right.
All right?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean this in some grand metaphysical Hegelian sense, like there's an unfolding history. But just things happen and they require other things to develop to be maintained.
Right. And certain things push farther than others.
Right. And you don't see that happen until agriculture.
Right.
Whether or not you see that as a boon or a tragedy,
it happens.
Is what value judgment.
Right.
Yeah.
I just before we skip, I don't necessarily want to skip ahead of before agriculture. You seem to be suggesting that symbolic kinship is the sort of nice mode of analysis for pre-agricultural times, and after agricultural times, materialist explanation in the standard kind of German ideology sense becomes more and more relevant. Is that the impression I'm getting?
Yes. However, symbolic kinship and the forms of symbolic kinship are very important for the forms that develop out of material relations.
I see.
And this is why societies are different.
Hmm. So this is the interaction between the micro and the macro, where it's like how they influence each other.
Right. It is also a relationship to the complexity of society. As society becomes more complex, the justifications for that society and the ways that symbolic kinship would work as far as divisions and hierarchies within the group itself will become larger and larger.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that eventually, for example, if you look at like Anglo-Saxons, the classes, say in Anglo-Saxons, you don't even really see people of a different class from you as a part of your ethnoi.
Hmm.
Okay? Like,
when is
like,
this, by the way?
This is 9th, 10th century.
Right. BC.
AD.
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 Yeah.
really late, right. But this is still this is post-antiquity.
Right.
Now, this develops out of feudalism. Feudalism develops out of a weird combination of the failure of currency to take off before a strongly centralized individual state.
Right. Yeah.
So we're getting really ahead of the future.
Yeah, let's not get it.
But symbolic kinship is still important.
Sure.
Because the idea of who's part of the kingdom and who they are. All right? Are you a Wessex or an Essex?
Right.
Anglo-Saxon, are you a Dane?
Right.
Are you a Welsh, which just means foreigner, but you know, would have been a Romano-Celt or a Romano-British.
Right.
Are you any of these things? These ideas of what we think of more of ethnicity and proto-race.
Right.
Come in from symbolic kinship.
Okay.
Now, in times of stress, symbolic kinship tends to become less and less symbolic and more just like plain old kinship.
Right. But obviously it's become complicated because the sort of straightforward family ties have sort of weakened across years of economic development.
Right. The idea of race as we think of it really complicates this.
Right.
Actually. Because what race is kind of a broad feudalist proxy for symbolic kinship. It's still symbolic.
Right.
But kind of like, it's a, kind of a blunt instrument symbolic. Like, oh, this person has the same mythology as me. They're probably related. We are probably a people. But this is why, even now, if you jump between cultures, even cultures that are related, directly related, like Britain and the United States, do not actually have the same fine-tooth definitions of race.
Mm.
What counts as white is different between Britain and the U.S. All right, and that is a fairly contiguous culture.
Did you find this podcast helpful? Maybe it helped you to clarify your thinking for your own radical project? If so, you might subscribe to the Zero Books podcast feed and keep listening. And if you really got a lot out of this podcast, you might consider leaving a review on iTunes. Or you might decide to join the Zero Books Club. You'll find links to the Zero Books Club in this week's show notes. Thanks for listening.